Today on Maine Calling, authors who write to save the planet. Throughout history, books have helped spark awareness and even social movements. Think about anti-slavery and Uncle Tom's Cabin or migrant farm workers and the Grapes of Wrath. A new generation of authors is using their talents to amplify climate and environmental issues. I'm Jennifer Rooks. There's even a nickname for a subgenre of these books, Cli-Fi. Today on Maine Calling, we will meet three authors who hope their work inspires readers to care about the climate and to take action. One Maine author has launched an initiative called Be the Butterfly, which encourages people to make one small change. Fiction, nonfiction, poetry. Can books be the catalyst the planet needs? Maine Calling is just ahead.
Maine Calling is made possible in part by Rennie's, a Maine shopping adventure with 19 locations across the state, now open in Bangor and Waterville, and by Maine Seacoast Mission, delivering health care, education, and support to islands and coastal Down East communities. Learn more at seacoastmission.org.
I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Today we talk with writers who hope that their words and stories inspire readers to do something about climate change. Do you think that reading a novel or a poem can prompt you to take action? Joining me for this hour, Kate Woodworth, who is the author of the new novel, Little Great Island. She often writes about climate change, and she is the founder of the Be the Butterfly initiative. Julie Carrick-Dalton is the author of Waiting for the Night Song and The Last Beekeeper. She is a former farmer, beekeeper, and journalist who now teaches at Drexel University and Tufts University. And Haley Talbert is author of the poetry collection Precipice, which she wrote while she was a student at Falmouth High School. She is now at Yale University, where she writes for the Yale Daily News. We invite you to join the conversation. Have you ever read a book that opened your eyes or inspired you to get involved with a particular cause? Is there a novel about climate change that made an impression on you? You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, post a comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Welcome to all of you. Kate, I'll start with you. Your book, Great Little Island, has gotten a lot of great reviews just out. It's a novel, and at its heart is a climate change message. Tell us about it.
Thank you. It's a joy to be here. And Little Great Island, really, to me, at its heart, it's a love story for an island off the coast of Maine. It's the story of this community really needing to reinvent itself in the face of climate change. Specifically, the lobster population is dropping precipitously. I didn't really intend to write a climate novel. I really wanted to just write a love story to this island in Maine that really that holds a special place in my heart. But at the same time, I was really concerned about what was happening with the climate. And I suddenly realized that that was the place where I could make a difference, was to write about what is going on right now, not one of these great catastrophes that we hear about, but just that day-to-day change in the environment that's really impacting people's lives.
And I'm wondering if people on the island have read it already, and if any lobstermen have read it. Have you gotten responses?
Yes, I have to tell you that those were the critics I worried about most. I was actually on both Vinyl Haven and North Haven about a week ago. And the one critic I was most nervous about is a gentleman named Foy Brown. He's the fifth generation owner of Brown's Boatyard on North Haven. And I was laughing with him. I said, at this point, if Foy likes it, you know you wrote an okay book. Happily, Foy likes the book.
Wonderful. Congratulations. Well, let me ask you, because you didn't, I want to say just, that's the wrong word. You didn't just write a novel, but you didn't just write a novel. You also started an initiative called Be the Butterfly. So tell me about that name, Be the Butterfly. Some people may get it and some may not. And then what are you hoping your initiative will do?
There's a little bit of background here, which is that I worked for many years as a medical writer in a cancer center. And so one of the things I really learned about that is that a lot of times, if you're not the person who's been diagnosed with family or a family member, people don't know what to say. They don't know how to talk about it. And if you are the person with a diagnosis, what really helps is action. And I think I took those lessons with me when I was thinking about how to make this book something that was more than just a story that people read. I really wanted people to feel empowered to take action about the climate. There is a character in the book, Mr. Estabrook, who is known as the butterfly diplomat. In his career, he was a diplomat, and he's always telling people to think of the butterfly effect, to be the butterfly, to be that first flap of the wings that can have huge repercussions in the world. So I took those thoughts and kind of put them together and said, what would happen if I invited readers to be the butterfly by doing one small thing on a daily basis that could help impact the climate? My publisher suggested that I actually include this in the book and come up with a dozen nonprofits that were climate related that people could support if they chose. And I thought about it and I thought there's so many writers out there, like your other guests on this show, who are already working in this space. And so I reached out to them and asked them to suggest the name of a nonprofit that was working on conservation and the climate. And so we got a dozen people who are participating, including Julie Carrick Dalton.
Well, Julie, thank you. Kate, thank you. And I was about to turn to Julie. So as Kate says, you're one of the authors that Kate includes in the Be the Butterfly initiative. She recommends your novels. Talk about what this is, how this intersection of caring about the planet and climate change and your work has worked for you. Are your novels directly about climate change and the environment, or is it like Kate, where they're about something else, but this has worked its way in?
Well, thank you for having me. I'm really excited to be part of this conversation. So like Kate, I did not set out to write novels about climate change. As after I wrote my first novel that someone said to me, oh, you wrote a climate fiction novel. And it was a term I hadn't really heard before. I write about things that are on my heart. I had been farming a piece of land in New Hampshire and keeping bees at the time I was writing my first novel. And what I like to think about my novels as manifestations of my own climate anxieties. There were things that I was thinking about, things that made me anxious about our climate future. And I was imagining stories around them and letting my characters work out the things that I was uncomfortable about. My first novel is called Waiting for the Night Song, and it's about an invasive beetle infestation in an agricultural community and what it does, it was during a drought, and what it does to the community. But that's the backdrop of the story. The story is about the people living in that town, the relationships, the community, and the day-to-day lives of people with climate change occurring in the background, because that's all of us. If we live on planet Earth, if we drink water and breathe air, we are part of the climate crisis. So in The Last Beekeeper, as the name suggests, it's about a beekeeper. As a beekeeper myself, I witnessed a giant die-off of all of my bees in a single day. And it really had a devastating effect on my psyche, because I cared about the bees because I'd raised them, I'd nurtured them. And I also cared about them as a need for our society or for global agriculture and food security. And when I saw my own bees die off, in a pile, like a literal pile of about 40,000 bees in my yard, it made me confront it visually of what would happen if we actually lost our pollinators. And I started doing a lot of research about what the world would look like, and we would lose a third of the food on Earth if we lost our pollinators. So I envisioned a future, The Last Beekeeper, set in the near future, not very far in the future. I don't put a date on it, but it has a slight dystopian vibe. But what it does is imagines a world just like ours right now, if our pollinators suddenly died off. what it would do to our food security system, to to big agriculture, to our economies, global and local economies, politics. It really has a trickle-down effect. Like this one little creature, these insects would really upend our society, and all of it has to do with climate change. But like Kate's story being about an island she loves, all of my books are about a community that I care about and people and characters that I care about that are operating with climate change in the background, the backdrop of the story.
And Julie, what has the reaction to your novels been, especially more recent, The Last Beekeeper?
So I've gotten a lot of emails from people who tell me about their own beekeeping experiences. My grandmother kept bees. I'm thinking about keeping bees. What do you recommend? Reaching out to me. And I ne will never claim to be an expert on beekeeping. I'm not an entomologist or an apiary specialist. I'm more of a hobbyist. I tell people that I love bees. In fact, when my editor, when she was reading it the first time, her reaction to it was, "Julie, you write about bees the way other people write about puppies. Not everybody thinks bees are that cute." So one of my internal motivators in writing this book was to make other people love bees, not just because they're cute and fuzzy and make great cartoon characters, or because they make honey and wax and things that we care about, but we need them. Like we need them so much. And I also want people, when people reach out to me and ask me about the bees, I always turn it back to them and say, but don't forget about the other ones, the ones that aren't so cute, the wasps, the yellow jackets, the mosquitoes, the creatures we don't love so much. We need them just as much. And I think of bees as like the gateway insect to thinking about the,
The
pollinator
gateway
crisis.
flying insect, okay.
Exactly. It's like the gateway drug to caring about bugs. And I think that people, it resonates with people. Like if they can attach themselves some emotional, some resonance with a beekeeper. The story follows a beekeeper and his daughter as their bees die off, and about their relationship unraveling as the bees die and how they find their way back to each other. There's something very relatable about a relationship breaking down, a father-daughter relationship breaking down. And it's happening in the backdrop of society unraveling. And I think that it reels people in and it makes them see themselves in the story. What would I do if they're,
Oh.
in this situation?
I want to turn to you, Haley. You wrote your poetry collection, your first poetry collection that was published called Precipice as a high school student, and it was published through the Telling Room in Portland a couple years ago. So even as a teenager, you were motivated to use your talent as a writer to do something about climate change. Did you set out to write about climate change, or were you like Kate and Julie that you kept finding your poems being about climate change?
I believe it's a combination of both. For one, there's this broader anxiety shared among many young people about climate change that I was witnessing. And I had to speak to that. I was very fortunate. I owe so much to the Telling Room for helping me tell that story, empowering young people to tell stories about climate change, about any kind of, anxiety they might have about the future, and to get those voices heard, because they're often voices that are not shared. Youth concerns about the climate. But I do find that most of my poems end up cycling back to climate change in some way. I mean, climate change manifests minutiae, right? And what is poetry about than these like small moments each day that dilate into something larger, where we're noticing a change that might seem very slight and we're writing about that, but it's really indicative of a larger concerning trend. So I find the job of a poet, regardless of what you're kind of concern is finding how this broader topic for me, it's climate change and environmental devastation that I'm concerned with, is manifesting in the mundane. So I definitely say it's a combination of both trying to speak to a larger concern of my generation, and voices that are not being heard and elevated, even though we're taking the future and having to deal with these issues. And seeing it everywhere, which I'm sure, we all do. And once you start noticing these small changes and shifting baselines, it's difficult to go back.
And Haley, let me ask you, now that you're in college, do you continue to write poetry and do you continue to focus your work on the climate and the environment?
I do. I do. Again, I feel like everything does cycle back to that. I recently finished a second poetry manuscript, and I'm working on trying to get that published, and everything ends up being about climate change, whether I try to make it about that or not. So there's definitely a climate focus there, and specifically tied to Maine. You know, I've lived in Maine nearly my entire life, so everything comes back to that. And now leaving the state and seeing the concerns that other places have, I find that my journalism that I've gotten involved with is also concerned around the environment and climate as well. And I'm also a painter, so I call myself a painter tentatively. I'm learning, but I love to plant in plein air and going out to locations around Maine and really getting in touch with time and grounding myself in a place allows me to appreciate what we have now, but also, you know, entrench kind of this concern that my children someday won't be able to appreciate these places in the same way. So I think all of this work just comes back to being grounded and appreciating these really like small changes and small moments and a large focus on place that allows me to see these issues and try to speak about them through different outlets. So I'm definitely not stopping poetry now that I'm in college.
Well, good luck getting your manuscript published. We're going to turn now to Ivan Fernandez, co-chair of the Scientific and Technical Subcommittee for the Maine Climate Council and professor emeritus and climate research scientist with the University of Maine. Thanks for giving us a call, Ivan.
You bet. Thanks for the opportunity, Jennifer. Great panel this morning.
Oh, thank you. We're going to circle back to Kate's idea, the butterfly effect, the initiative that if each of us does one thing every day, we can make a difference. You know, to some people that may sound like the best idea, to Ivan, to others that might say it's not enough, it's not even a drop in the bucket. What does the research show us?
Well, I think there's two aspects of an answer to that question. One is what we kind of see happening all around us in society and the intersection of science and society, and then some of it is certainly what the research itself shows us. You know, I think the butterfly effect concept is focusing on the what we as an individual can do, and that's made even more important as we're experiencing a federal assault on science and climate progress, with the burden of the future increasingly falling on subnational levels of government, which is code for state government and local government, and on us as individuals. I think the opportunities that we have every day in our lives to have an effect are very impactful. And I love the notion of literature essentially can't avoid in many ways incorporating the aspects of climate change because it's all around us with more to come. I think we too often think of major policy initiatives as the only way that big climate change actions take place. And yet every day we as individuals make numerous decisions on from obviously the voting booth, but in the grocery store, energy purchases, how we manage our farms, our forests, and how we treat each other. All of it matters. And big policy actions, yes, are impactful, but they wouldn't happen if no one cared. And I think the dialogue here is about how much we are learning from each other and through the arts. There's a growing body of social science that's part of the science around climate change that has to do with, I think, what underlies the butterfly effect. Concepts like peer-to-peer learning, some of that terminology is simply saying, instead of the experts going, you know, one way talking to the individuals, it's people that, like all of us, tend to learn from each other and what we see and who we trust. Another sort of concept that this discussion reminded me of is a climate shadow and the notion that what we do casts a shadow that impacts the world around us. It's kind of what we do in our daily lives that affects all of us, and that ripples across society, collectively giving us kind of the momentum that we certainly desperately need.
Ivan, I'm going to put you on the spot and ask you, because I do need to go to a break, would you be able to stay with us for just a little bit longer? Great, because I have a little more to ask you, but we do, I did look at the clock. So we are talking about writers and personal action and caring about the climate and how books and articles and poems affect all of us. They affect culture, they affect us as individuals, and they affect the planet. We're going to take a quick break. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. We're talking with three authors about the intersection between writing and climate change and the idea that small climate actions add up and that individuals can make a difference. Joining me, Julie Carrick Dalton, a novelist and former farmer and journalist. She's a faculty member at Drexel University and a visiting professor at Tufts University. Haley Talbert is an alumnus of The Telling Room in Portland, which led to the publication of her book of poetry centered on climate change themes. She is now studying at Yale. Kate Woodworth has a new novel out. It is called Little Great Island, and she founded the Be the Butterfly Initiative to promote the power of small actions to combat climate change. Share your comments and questions about this idea of individuals stepping forward to mitigate climate change, or tell us about a book you've read that made a difference to you. Send a brief email, talk@mainpublic.org. You can also post on Facebook or Instagram or call 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. Ivan, give us some ideas. Kate says that we can all do one thing every day. What is one thing that you would recommend each of us could do every day?
Well, obviously, there are many that have large and small impacts. Something that's probably the easy to implement is how we think about our diet and the carbon intensity of various foods, and some being more carbon intense than others, aside from kind of the health impacts. How we use energy and decisions we make on our energy systems and our homes. Obviously, EVs as compared to internal combustion engine is a big contrast and also a big decision, but just simply how we drive has an impact on fuel efficiency for those that are in a fossil fuel vehicle. I think paying attention and how we manage our, if we are fortunate to own a piece of property and have a garden and plants, how we manage those soils and preserving the carbon and growing plants that are storing carbon, but also growing a diversity of plants so that we're mindful of how that impacts the wildlife that are also, the biota of the world we're in are also experiencing the changing climate just like we are.
Kate, what kind of ideas do you have on the Be the Butterfly Initiative?
I have many ideas and have been fortunate enough to implement a number of them in our home, but what's been really exciting for me is to hear what others have declared as their butterfly acts, because inviting them to come up with something gives them the opportunity to look at what is doable in their own lives. I spoke in an elementary school, and one example from there was a sixth grader who said she was not going to use the dryer during the summer. She was going to hang her clothes out on the line. What a great idea. I have spoken with people who have agreed to purchase an EV. A number of people have talked about starting a pollinator garden. And then some of the things that we've been talking about recently have had to do with composting, food composting, which people are actually very excited about. And because there are so many companies available now that will even do curbside pickup of your food waste, it's really a pretty easy opportunity for people. They get the compost back, they can improve the quality of the soil. So those are a couple of the ideas that people have come up with, and I've been really pleased to see those kinds of things that people find they really can implement easily.
And I'll ask Julie and Haley as well. Julie, are there things that you're incorporating into your day-to-day life that maybe you didn't before you started working on your novels?
Well, I think that the time period that I was building my farm was the same time period I was writing my first book. And I think they happened hand in hand. They happened at the same time. One wasn't before the other. We were early adopters of solar panels. We put solar panels in our house in 2007. And now we plug a car into that house with the solar panels. And I get a lot of joy out of thinking of the sun going right into my vehicle and not using any gas. And I also have been a vegetarian for about 20 years, which I love talking to people about that. I don't like being an aggressive vegetarian and telling other people what to do, but I like sharing recipes and talking about ways to incorporate vegetarian meals into other people's diets. But I think the biggest change I've had since I started writing books is I feel like I have a voice. I feel empowered to talk to other people about climate change when I didn't, because I'm not a scientist, I'm not a climatologist. I didn't think I had the right to go out and talk to people about climate science and climate change, but I do. I live on Earth. I'm part of the ecosystem, and I have as much stake in it as anybody else. And what I have is story. So when I go to book clubs and I'm able to share my story, invite people to kind of enter my world, to give up their own worldview for 10 hours to read my book, to see the world through my eyes and then talk about it, is an amazing gift. My favorite experience was a book club that I went into that really challenged me, asking me if I thought climate change was controversial because not everybody agreed with it. Did my publisher push back? And I could tell that they didn't enter this book in the same place I entered it. But at the end of the book club, they invited me back with my next book because I wanted to talk about it. And what I felt like I had done is I had started a conversation. Did I change everybody's mind about everything that day? I don't think so. But I handed them characters that they identified with a story. There was a love story embedded in it. There was some drama. They liked the story. They allowed me to give them my worldview temporarily. And it started a conversation. So I think that's what I have learned most from becoming an author, is that I do have a place at this table to talk about climate change, even though I'm not a scientist. And I would invite everybody to do that. Whatever you're doing, whatever your field is, you have a role. If you work in a doctor's office and want to use better, trash management practices, or if you work on a farm and want to go organic, whatever your field is, there's a place for you in the conversation about climate. And I feel like that's the biggest message I would like to deliver to people.
And Haley, what about in your personal life?
Yeah, so I believe that the greatest kind of weapon that we have in combating climate change is hope. And there are a lot of things that diminish hope. One might be, reading the national news. I think a lot of people start their days engaging with news. And when you're seeing, lofty issues that you're like, I have no power over this in any kind of way and no impact, maybe engaging with local news is one way to help. So I've thought a lot about the news that I am consuming. And reading local journalism has actually helped me feel like I have a lot more power over, these environmental issues and climate change, because you see how they're, manifesting and taking shape at a local level that's very approachable. You can make impact in your community if you focus on, reading local writers, looking at what's happening in maybe your town or your state. That is a great way to bolster hope, because these are actually things that we have some sort of agency over. Yes, you do have agency over larger issues, but it's very easy to feel very small and helpless when you're looking at things on a national or global scale. It also, again, any kind of grassroots community movement is a great help, and being aware of what's happening, again, in your community and town is a huge way to create this kind of butterfly ripple effect. So I've been a lot more conscious, I think, of what news I'm consuming and what I want to be informed of. Of course, we all want to be informed of everything that's happening, but there are only so many hours in the day. So lately I've been focusing on what's happening locally.
All right. This is part of a bigger conversation. This conversation about what can we do for the climate seems to be everywhere. And I'm going to play here. We're going to play an example of how it's permeated popular culture. This is a clip from the TV show Modern Family, and it's an episode I happened to see about the same time I started thinking about doing this program.
Hey there, neighbor.
Oh, hey. It's Asher, right?
Yeah. I just wanted to let you know, I think there might be something wrong with your air conditioner.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I mean, it just seems to be running a lot, even when it's kind of cool outside.
Oh, no, my partner runs a little hot. So.
Not as hot as our planet. Sorry, I don't mean to be that guy. It's just, we're all in this together.
Yeah, I drive a Prius, so...
And that's a nice little gesture. My car runs on reclaimed cooking oil. I have some literature if you want it.
That's okay, save the paper.
I haven't printed anything since 2004. I was gonna email you.
On your power-hungry computer?
My entire house is solar-powered. I sell energy back to the grid and use that money to save polar bears.
So, of course, we had to play that clip. Ivan, I want to turn to you before we let you go. And I think what this touches on, it's pretty funny, of course, but also that, like, you know, there's this balance between wanting to do the right thing, needing to live our lives, not wanting to sort of eco-shame people. When you hear this, when you hear this clip and you're, you know, sort of just thinking about the work that you do, how do you think about the bigger picture and how culturally and psychologically and socially we need to be talking about this?
Yeah, that's great. I mean, it is funny. And there's some obviously really important messages in that clip. I'll often talk about the kinds of actions that we've mentioned here today to address climate change that we each can do personally, and also then say I'm not a fan of guilt, that if we are, you know, mindful of the reality of the world that we live in and we do our best, that we pay attention to opportunities to do better. But if we end up buying a hybrid and not a full EV, or if we read in an article that something we're doing actually isn't as energy efficient as we thought it was, that's okay. I think we're trying to find out every day answers to questions. Guilt doesn't really get us anywhere. But as long as we're trying to do better each day, I think that's the right direction. And by and large, most of the actions indeed are positive. And it goes kind of without saying, including being mindful of what we do in the voting booth and the leadership, because that most easily trickles up to the big policy decisions that are being made every day. So I love the clip. I'm not a fan of guilt. Everyone just do the best they can and pay attention. One last comment is, I love the discussion around hope in our last science assessment. We included a chapter on hope itself, having noting that it takes agency, the ability to do it, goals, which we have, and a pathway to get there. And Maine's climate action plan called Maine Won't Wait, of course, embodies that exact pathway. So there's plenty of opportunity to engage and do good things.
Well, Ivan, thank you so much for calling in and taking part in the conversation and staying on a little longer than you planned. That's Ivan Fernandez with the Maine Climate Council and also the University of Maine. If you'd like to join the conversation, we'd love to hear from you. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. Our email address, talk@mainepublic.org. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. We're talking about what the written word can do to promote climate action. Joining me, Haley Talbert, who authored a poetry collection called Precipice when she was with the Telling Room as a teenager. She is now at Yale, where she is staff reporter for the university newspaper. Kate Woodworth is the author of Little Great Island. She also wrote Racing in the Dark and founded Be the Butterfly to promote the idea that small actions can have an impact on climate change. Also with us, Julie Carrick-Dalton, a former farmer who is the author of novels that also tackle themes about the changing climate. She is with Drexel University and Tufts University. You can share your comments and questions by email, talk@mainepublic.org, or give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. 1-800-273-8266. A note here letting you know that Maine Public launched Planet Maine, a climate newsletter, in April. Our climate reporter Molly Enking has been writing a twice-monthly column called Phase In, Phase Out, about changes individuals can make to fight climate change. So let's see. We'll go to Kitsy, who's calling from Portland. Hi, Kitsy. Go ahead.
Hi, Jen. Thank you for this fabulous program. I wanted to start with just recommending. I haven't written, but I'm an avid reader, and there is a, like, the Bible of this whole movement, and the title is Silent Spring Revolution, put together by Douglas Brinkley. And it just says, Doris Kern Goodwin says, you've got to read it for the history of all of what we've been trying to do and an impetus to continue. But I wanted to also pick up on the butterfly thing. I live at the atrium at the Cedars, and we have two staff people, one here at the atrium and her husband who oversees the whole grounds of the Cedars. And we, for the past 4 years, thanks to them, have been raising monarch butterflies in the atrium downstairs. And she puts together terrarium. She brings in the milkweed. We see the eggs. She brings the eggs. We see them. We can just watch them grow through all of the stages. And when they emerge as ready to fly, she invites us to come down. And you have to let them go within a couple of days because, you know, once their wings dry out, they really need to be out. And so we're allowed to release, and last year I think we released 150 monarch butterflies, which was really incredible. And my life, starting in the 70s, has been, you know, concentrated primarily on saving the planet. And the one, I was arrested 3 times, mostly about nuclear power, which I didn't realize in the 70s had to do all with nuclear weaponry. And one of the times I became a part of the Clamshell Alliance and went and occupied the Seabrook construction site in New Hampshire with 1,200 others. We were arrested, incarcerated in 5 New Hampshire armories for a week. And it was an amazing, I've never had a richer week in my life. I was
Kitsy,
in the Dover.
It sounds like you've been a butterfly for a long time. Thank you so much for calling in and sharing that. I'm going to go to some more emails here. This is from Deb. Please consider Kim Stanley Robinson's books. I love them, and they have made a great impact on me. Julie and Kate, you're both nodding. Who wants to tell us about those?
I'll jump in. I am a huge fan of Ministry for the Future, which is a story that imagines a world where we have a UN agency or a department that is focused on litigating on behalf of the future. So if you imagine that if we had an organization that could sue companies for the damage they're doing right now on behalf of future generations, how powerful that would be. Reading that book helped me imagine writing a book, a future-oriented story, because I think imagining the future gives us a lot of power. Kim Stanley Robinson's novels let us imagine a world either that we would want to be in or one that we don't want to be in. And when we can fully imagine it, it helps us take action either to achieve the world as we want it or to avoid a world. And so I love his books for that. They're so rich, so imaginative that you can really see yourself in that world, and it empowers you.
And then an email here from Agnes. Please mention the book A Dangerous New World that was published by Literal Books in 2019. It is a collection of essays and poetry by over 50 Maine writers and includes artwork by 30 Maine artists. This book sounds the alarm about climate change in Maine and is well worth reading. And then Susan here by email has a suggestion, a way to be the butterfly. She says, driving gas cars to lower fuel use. As an electric car owner, it also applies to EVs. She's talking about acceleration, she says. Enormous acceleration reduces range, thus increasing electric charging. Sticking to the speed limit versus 5 or 9 miles over increases range. So Susan is saying, just slow down a little bit and you're doing something good for climate change. I want to return to you a little bit, Haley, though, to talk about your generation and the climate anxiety that so many young people feel. And you're talking about hope, because it feels to me like, and I'm guessing it feels to you that way a little bit as well, that you may be fighting a tsunami here, that young people are feeling overwhelmed and it's hard for them to be hopeful. Is that what you find?
I do. I find that when we're tasked with confronting so many issues that will continue to carve our future, it's difficult to retain any kind of hope. And again, by focusing on smaller actions, you can feel hopeful. But I do think it's a larger anxiety of responsibility, where we are forced to confront these issues, because otherwise we don't really have a future, or a future for our kids, you know, our grandkids. It's not necessarily a choice, but a true responsibility. And I find that, again, that we're playing a difficult balancing game in how much to focus on these issues and how much to let them define our lives, and how to take on the problems without allowing them to consume, you know, our hope. When you feel the weight of the world on your shoulders, you know, how do you proceed? And yes, it's definitely important to tackle these issues bit by bit, because otherwise, if you're, you know, looking at every global issue as a responsibility, it's a lot. But as a collective, I believe that we have a lot of power over our future and over making progress. We just have to retain that hope and amplify it.
Kate, I'm going to use a literary analogy here. Do you ever feel as though you're tilting at windmills? I mean, there are so many people on this planet. There are so many people moving, using transportation. There are so many people using electricity. There are so many parts of our world, parts of our economy that use a lot of resources, even as they're doing good. I'm thinking about hospitals, for example. Does it ever feel like maybe we may be being a little naive by saying we're going to raise some butterflies and help?
Absolutely. It absolutely does. And I think anyone who is really involved in this fight at the moment has periods of real discouragement. But one of the things that's really kept me motivated is the community of people who are concerned about what's going on with the climate. I'm thinking here particularly of Bill McKibben, who founded Third Act and who is one of the butterflies. He's out there constantly right now talking about the power of solar energy. And he is promoting right now Sunday, which is September 21st, and is a celebration of the power of sustainable energy sources, particularly the sun. I think the other thing that really keeps me motivated is people like Haley. The younger people, I'm a woman of a certain age. I will probably not be here for some of the terrible effects that people are saying we could be facing. That's not an excuse. That means that I have that much more responsibility to elevate voices of the younger people who are going to be inheriting this planet and have a right to a habitable planet.
All right, we'll go to Priscilla calling from Portland. Hi, Priscilla, go ahead.
Yeah, hi, I'm a naturopathic doctor here, and I'm so concerned about our environment. You know, the plants, the animals, the air we breathe, the food we're eating, it's contaminated with pesticides and all kinds of chemicals that we're using, and that's behind a lot of what's going on with our health. So we've really got to pay attention to climate change and what's causing it. And there's a couple of books. You know, one is Joanna Macy, who recently passed away. And 22 years ago, she wrote a book called Industrial Growth, called Back to Life. And in it, she talks about the problem that we're facing today with our democracy. We're suffering from an industrial growth society, and we've got to change that to a life-sustaining society. And that's what we're up against in this day and age, and especially in our democracy is up against that. So we've really got to pay attention to it. So I think her book would be a good one to read. Again, it's called Come Back to Life by Joanna Macy and Mary Young Brown. And another one is by Robin Wall Kimmerman called The Serviceberry. That's an excellent. She's a Native American scientist, and she's from Maine. She's the Serviceberry. It's a short book, and it's really easy to read, and will really point out the same thing that Joanna Macy's pointing out. So I think those are a couple of good books to read.
Thank you, Priscilla, for calling in and joining the conversation. We'll move to Jane, who's calling from VZ. Hi, Jane. Go ahead.
Hi, how are you? I would like to just say I've been active in alternative energy stuff since 1975, and I would just like to make a distinction for your listeners, very important. When this hit me, it was like a thunderbolt. The difference between hope and optimism. Hope is a feeling. It's a feeling. It's a wonderful feeling, but it's just a feeling. Optimism is an action verb. And what I mean by that, and what Edward Shackleton explained when he said how he made it back after 15 months in the Antarctic with his entire crew alive, was he said, optimism is true moral courage. Optimism is looking at all that could possibly go wrong. Very realistic. It's not Pollyanna. It's like, okay, this could happen. Then you look at maybe this could happen. And from then on, you give all of your time, all of your energy, all of your creativity into figuring out what you can do to move in that direction. And don't give a lot of space in your head for the negative stuff. In 1978 or 9, when we had the Arab oil crisis, the people of this country voluntarily reduced their speed limits to 55 miles an hour, and they turned their heat back at night to 55 degrees. And the Department of Energy has statistics, unfortunately, I don't have the citation, of the amount of energy that was saved in this country by people voluntarily, without ever anybody noticing them or applauding them or anything, made a huge difference in the amount of energy demand we have in this country.
Jane, it's so interesting that you bring up this analogy or this point and this idea of slowing down, because, of course, we heard that from another emailer just a minute ago from Susan. And then now we have an email from Bruce that says, use cruise control. Stop caring that people are passing you. Travel in the travel lane so that you don't force others to pass on your right. So a lot of people talking about not just what we drive, but the way we drive. So thank you, Jane, for calling in. And I want to turn to you, Haley, because Jane's idea of the way that she's thinking about the difference between hope and optimism, you brought up the idea of hope. Does that resonate with you?
Absolutely. I really think that is an important distinction, and optimism cannot exist without hope. So hope needs to be the foundation of optimism. But I do completely agree that optimism is what drives the change. But my hope is that I wish that my generation can retain that hope, that then we need to light the fire of optimism that is going to make the change. But I do find that a lot of young people are losing hope itself, and without that, you can't have that optimism that's so crucial.
And before we have just about a minute left, Julie, I'll ask you about this idea of retaining hope and optimism in the face of what you've been finding in your research. For example, when you were researching what would happen if the bees went away.
One of the things I thought a lot about was paralysis. Because I think we have, a fight, flight, or paralysis response to danger, and climate change is a danger. And we could either give up hope and flee, or we could get in the fight. But we don't want to be paralyzed by grief or projection of grief in anticipation of loss of species or loss of climate. But I think it's about falling in love with what's still here, and having the optimism to fight for it. Whether it's fighting for bees, whether it's fighting for your local watershed, having the optimism, as Haley had said, looking at something local and knowing that you have the capacity to make a change somewhere and not giving into the paralysis of fear and grief.
All right. And Kate, you're nodding. This is what the Butterfly Effect Initiative is all about, right?
It absolutely is. Find some action that works for you in your life and do it. It keeps climate change in your consciousness and it helps give you a sense of power and hope.
Well, thank you all of you for joining us today. Kate Woodworth is the author of Little Great Island and the founder of the Be the Butterfly Initiative. Julie Carrick-Dalton is the author of Waiting for the Night Song and The Last Beekeeper. Her third novel, The Forest Becomes Her, will come out next year. And Haley Talbert is author of the poetry collection Precipice. She's from Falmouth. She's a student at Yale University. Today's sound engineer was Chris Bridges. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow on the program, we check in on Maine's restaurant scene and find out why restaurants play a role in our well-being. There's a new study about that. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.